Samantha King is 8 weeks pregnant when the UK enters its first lockdown. It is the start of a lonely pregnancy where social interactions and midwifery appointments are reduced to Zoom meetings and telephone consultations. The limited antenatal care has significant implications for Samantha and her birth experience. Gestational diabetes and preeclampsia are only suspected after the birth of her 11.3 pounds baby. It is at times a difficult story and is therefore not for everyone. But it is a story that sadly is not unique to Samantha and needs to be told. It brings into focus the importance of good maternity care and why, if there is ever another lockdown, we must ensure that women continue to receive adequate support and care throughout pregnancy, birth and motherhood. With us in the studio is Nairi Wright, midwife and founder of Sage Plan, to answer any questions. You're listening to the podcast To Become a Mother, and my name is Caroline Johansson. Welcome, Samantha.
Thank you.
And welcome, Nairi.
Hi.
Hi. Samantha, you are mom to Henry, who is 20 months.
20 months, yes. Yeah, growing fast.
Yeah. And it's his birth story we will hear about today. To start with, I'd like to go back to when you and your partner started talking about having a baby. Can you take us back to that time?
Yeah, so we got married in 2017. And we decided, you know, we're going to wait a little bit until we start trying, just because, you know, obviously financially, we just bought a house, we just got married, the two most expensive things you can kind of do within a year. And we're like, I think to throw a child in the mix is a bit silly at the moment. And then around 6 months later, we're like, actually, you know what, we're never going to really be fully prepared to have a child. So why not start trying just in case there are issues? And I actually fell pregnant a few months after that, which unfortunately ended up in a miscarriage. It was an early miscarriage. I think I was only about 6-7 weeks, but it was a shock. And to have to go through that, after that, I was a bit like, you know what, let's just wait. There's no rush. I just wanted kind of time to heal and sort things out in terms of like with work and things like that. And then in January 2020, I turned 30 and we were actually in New York and we're like, okay, you know what? Feeling a little bit better. You know, maybe now's that maybe over the next few months, we'll see where it goes and we'll start trying again. And then little did I know when I got back 3 weeks later, I was actually pregnant. So,
wow.
Yeah, it kind of happened quite fast. And it was even though we'd spoken about starting a family, when you see those two red lines on a pregnancy stick, you're like, oh, wow, this is happening again.
Yeah.
Got there. And I was in the bathroom because my husband, David, he works really early shifts. So he leaves the house at like 5:30. And I got up and I was like, right, you know, first wee of the day, let's do this test. Because I felt different. I was really tired. And I was like, jet lag doesn't last this long. It can't be that. And I remember like my breasts were just like really tingly. And I was like, something's going on. Yeah. It's definitely different. And yeah, and took a test and I was like, oh my God. So I rang him at like 6:10 and he's like, what's wrong? What's wrong? I was like, I'm pregnant. And he's like, how do you feel? I was like, I feel good. Like, I feel fine. Like, yeah, this is good. This is good. And then, yeah, and then literally a couple of weeks later, had a bit of a scare. So I was out doing a day visit with work in Cambridge and I just went to the toilet. Obviously, I was fully aware that I was pregnant, but I was keeping it. We were very much keeping it to ourselves because what happened previously when I had the miscarriage months before, we'd obviously, you know, in the excitement, you tell your family, you tell a few close friends, and obviously then having to tell them actually I wasn't pregnant anymore. That was probably the worst part. So we're like, right, let's just keep it to ourselves and see what happens, see what progresses. And I went to the toilet and I wiped and there was blood. And immediately I just started to panic and think, oh God, this is happening again. And I went home and David came back from work and I was just in tears. And he was like, well, are you sure? I was like, but I'm bleeding. Like, I think I'm going to lose the baby again. So the next day I called the doctors and went in and they were like, you know, what's happened and things. And I said to him, like, I'm having another miscarriage. And the doctor actually said to me, he's like, let's take a breath. He's like, we don't know yet. This is a miscarriage. He said, so we're not counting it as a miscarriage. So I'm going to send you to the hospital. You'll have a scan and we'll see where it goes from there. So went to the hospital and the scanner that day had actually clocked off. So I had to wait another 2 days. And then I went in and I was actually in the same room where I found out about the miscarriage. So I was really anxious, really nervous, and I didn't want to look at the screen. I just looked at the ceiling. And all I heard was the nurse going, "Yeah, if you look at that screen there, that little red dot, the little black dot, that's your baby." I was just like, "Oh my God, I'm still pregnant." And then the realization of, "Oh my God, I'm actually pregnant." Then the whole world just went to pot with COVID. So
yeah. It must have been such a relief after those two agonizing days of seeing that.
Yeah.
So such good news.
I was so nervous because the doctor's like, you can go home and take a pregnancy test to make sure. And I didn't want to for the fear that I would start to see the lines getting faint again.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't go through that again. I was like, nope, I'm going to try and wait and we'll see what happens. And then because after I had the scan to confirm that, yes, I am actually pregnant, the nurse at the time then said, oh, we're going to bring you back in 2 weeks' time to make sure that the baby's actually growing and that everything's okay. So then I had another 2 week wait. And then when I finally went back and that was actually the last scan that my husband was allowed to come with me before the COVID restrictions came in. And we saw the little heartbeat and you could just see it moving, and it looks so tiny. It's just like a little bean, and it was just amazing. And so then that was the moment okay, right. Feeling a lot more comfortable about this.
Yeah. And so at 8 weeks pregnant, the country goes into lockdown.
Yes.
Is that right? Can you describe how your care changed after that?
Honestly, I didn't see anyone. I saw a midwife for my booking in appointment at the start of the 8 weeks, which was the Monday. And then by the Friday, that's when Boris announced everything is shutting down. Just stay home. No business is open. And then from that point on, I didn't see any medical help. My midwife appointments were switched to phone only. Mm. So having a telephone call every 3 to 4 weeks after that. And it was just the same generalization of, so how are you feeling? Is everything okay? And I assume so. It's my first time that I've got this far in my pregnancy. So
yeah.
I've got the morning sickness, got that, and the weather was really hot as well. So I had moments of getting really lightheaded if I was standing cooking and I'd have to sit down. And I was just told that that's normal. And I was told the whole way through, you've got, easy pregnancy, no concerns or anything. So you can have any kind of labor you want. So start thinking about it. And because in the midst of all this, I was furloughed as well. So at 8 weeks pregnant, country goes in lockdown. 9 weeks pregnant, I was furloughed. And then that was it. Mm. I was at home by myself, just getting rounder and just waiting for that 12-week scan. And even then, my 12-week scan was delayed by 2 weeks because for some reason, my information wasn't put on the system to trigger for me to get a letter to invite me in for my scan. So I was having to chase the local midwives and say, I haven't had my 12-week scan, I'm over 12 weeks. I'm really concerned because I want to make sure, everything's going well and stuff. And obviously I was aware that you're supposed to have certain tests done and that to make sure that, looking at the risks of if your baby has any issues. And I had to wait 2 weeks for that. And then I finally went in at 14 weeks and that's the first time I saw someone face to face. And then again, after that, I didn't see anyone face-to-face again until I had my 20-week scan. And then I didn't actually see a midwife until I was 28 weeks.
Wow. Going back to the tests that you do at 12 weeks, Nairi, what are those tests?
It's usually done between 11 and 13 weeks. So I'm not quite sure what they offered for you afterwards, but they work out the risk of your baby having a chromosome abnormality. And it's done through a scan, a blood test, and calculating the maternal age and combining those three things and then working out a risk. So one chromosome abnormality is trisomy 21 because it affects the 21st pair of chromosomes. And that's also called Down syndrome. So most people have heard of that one. But the other two, trisomy 13 and 18, are more serious but more unusual, Edwards and Patau syndrome. And it is really important to find out risk factors for those, because babies with those conditions often don't survive. And, you know, for anybody with a baby with a chromosome abnormality, they have lots of decisions to make. So finding out early is a good thing. And then if somebody is deemed to be high risk, which is calculated as the risk being greater than 1 in 250, they will then be offered something called non-invasive prenatal testing, which is where they can detect some of the baby's DNA in the mother's blood. It's pretty amazing, actually. And it's sort of taken over from the invasive tests that we may have known about before, the amniocentesis, etc. So it's a much more straightforward and accurate way of finding out if a baby has a problem like that. But they also will do a comprehensive scan at that 11 to 13 weeks where they look for other things as well. Mm-hmm. And because scan technology has moved on so much, things that they used to find out at 20 weeks, they're often able to discover much earlier. So it's a really important scan. And, you know, I dread to think about the people that were not as organized as you, Samantha, and pushed to find out what was going on. You know, I'm sure a lot of people perhaps just missed out on it altogether.
And how were you feeling otherwise physically? Were you okay throughout pregnancy, or did you have any ailments or other things?
So I had the lovely morning sickness, which wasn't just morning, it was all day. And I was quite grateful for being furloughed when that kicked in. Because in my previous job, I would travel all over the UK and it was a very social job, you know, late nights and things, and it centered around the alcohol industry. So obviously all those things I couldn't do, being pregnant and being sick. So I was, well, was quite grateful for being at home for that. And I think it lasted from maybe from when I was about 9 weeks up until I was about 22 weeks.
Oh, yeah, a long time.
A long time. But it wasn't like debilitating. I wasn't vomiting constantly. It would be, I'd vomit once or twice a day. And then it was just like having the worst hangover for those weeks. You just constantly feel like you're going to be sick, but you're not. And then the only time I would feel better is if I ate a jacket potato and had a can of Coke. That was the only thing that kind of settled my stomach for about an hour or so. So then I could have a nap. But it was just little quirks like that. But and my bump had started to show around 13 weeks is when it could really start to see like, okay, she's not just gained weight. Like it is actually a pregnant belly. And then I kind of, you know, grew gradually. And then I think is when I hit about 24 weeks and then just suddenly there was like a basketball there. And then it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And when I had my first face-to-face midwife appointment at 28 weeks, so obviously they do the measuring of the bump, and my estimate was that I was on the 50th centile, and they were like, that's good, that's healthy, you know, that's average, that's smack bang in the middle, that's perfect. And then at my next face-to-face appointment, which I believe was 32 weeks, it jumped up to the 97th centile.
Oh, wow.
And they said they were going to keep an eye on it, and if it dropped down, then they would put me forward for a scan. So then the next appointment came along and I was still at the 97th centile, so they left it. And I think that was kind of the time of when I started to have issues with swelling. My ankles were so swollen. Every time, you know, if I went out for a walk, which I did daily, I would come back and my ankles were like the size of my thighs. They were just huge. And I had to take all my rings off because my fingers were so swollen. And it was summer as well. So I just thought, oh, it's the heat. You know, pregnant during the heat, you're going to swell a bit and water retention and all that. And I didn't really think much of it. And then I started to flag it to them, the midwives, when I was having my face-to-face appointments, like, my ankles are really swollen. Like, is this normal? And they're like, yeah, it's fine. It's just part of being pregnant. And then even in one of my later appointments, I think it was around my due date. So my due date was the 26th of October. And it was coming up to that. And so they did it where they do the glorious cervix stretch. And the midwife even said, oh, I'm not going to ask you to take your leggings off because I can see your ankles are really swollen. So it was
picked up on,
but nothing really, not acted on. And then I think around that time as well, I'd had a urine sample that had been flagged as, something wasn't quite right. And so they sent it off to the doctors to request an appointment and further test. And it took 4 weeks to come through. So by the time that came through, I said, well, I've had two further urine tests that have come back clear. So if you think I still need to be checked, that's fine. But I'm just telling you, this is what's happened. And they said, oh, okay, we'll leave it then and we'll let it go. So I was like, okay,
Nari, in terms of swelling like that, is that something that midwives and maternity care professionals should be observant of?
We do expect some ankle swelling in the last month of pregnancy. It's normal, and also swelling of fingers. And it's definitely worse in hot weather. But, it's okay if it's just that in isolation. But what was missing in Samantha's case was a sort of thorough assessment of everything that was going on. Mm. And it's clear to see that a lot of that was because of COVID. So did you have a glucose blood test at 28 weeks?
So I did have that.
Yes.
And I was told that it was fine.
Okay.
But then after having Henry, and when I took Henry for his first set of jabs at 8 weeks, my doctor said to me, your glucose levels were high in your 28-week test.
Ah, so, that perhaps should have given some cause for concern then. But also, really, when you jumped from the 50th centile to the 97th, that should have been an immediate scan at that stage where an assessment was made. The urine, do you know what was found in the urine on that occasion?
I think
was
that
it
occasion,
protein?
Yeah, they said the protein level was high.
Okay. So that can be indicative of something called preeclampsia, and therefore the swelling in the legs becomes more significant because that swelling is also a symptom of preeclampsia. And how was your blood pressure, Samantha?
So I was told throughout that my blood pressure was fine. But again, I personally feel that because I didn't see a midwife from 8 weeks to 28 weeks, they might have just been benching it on what my blood pressure was at 28 weeks.
Yes.
We don't know what happened between those weeks.
No, absolutely.
Because obviously I wasn't tested for anything.
Yes.
And I personally think that that's probably why that wasn't looked at. And again, I am quite a tall person. I'm 5'10". And it was commented on like, oh, you're going to have a big baby. Like, because your height, is your husband tall? Are there, like, family members tall? And I was like, well, I'm 5'10". My husband's 6 foot. We've got brothers who are 6'2", 6'5", respectively. Mm. So it was always kind of mentioned that I was going to have a big baby, but no one kind of looked into it a bit further to actually confirm how big is big, pretty much.
Mm. Yes. It sounds like you were just the unfortunate victim of not good quality antenatal care.
Yeah.
And, it doesn't sound like it was a particular individual. It just sounds like the whole system, well, I know the whole system broke down because I was working in it. And I would say that the NHS is still really struggling now to recover.
Yeah.
And there are so many amazing people that work in it. But you were the victim of everything that went wrong during that period with the NHS.
Yeah.
And preeclampsia, can you just briefly describe what that is, Nari?
It's a complicated condition that involves many organs in the body and can be really serious for babies and for mums. And it often results in babies having to be born early. It increases the risk of serious problems like abruption of the placenta, of stillbirth, of hemorrhage, and ultimately women can fit. And it can cause maternal and baby death. So it can be a very serious condition, but if it's picked up nice and early and women get good treatment, it can be managed very well. But it does usually result in this sort of slightly earlier birth of a baby, even when it's well managed.
And so your due date is the 26th of
October. Yeah.
And when do you start feeling that something might be happening? on the labour front?
It was the 3rd of November. I woke up at 1 a.m. and I was like, something feels weird. Mm. And I went to the toilet and I saw that like the mucus plug had started to come away. So I was like, okay, I think this is the start of things. And then the contractions started and they were really, you know, at that point, you couldn't even time them. They were very sporadic. And obviously it's 1 a.m. and I was lying there like, maybe I've just got stomach ache, you know, maybe it may not even be contractions, but we'll just see. And because the 3rd of November was the Tuesday and I was told that if there were no signs, I'd be induced on the Friday, which was 2 weeks after my original due date. So I texted the midwife and I was like, contractions have started. So obviously I won't be at my appointment. It was booked for the next day. And I just remember the pain in my lower back and it was just getting worse and worse. And then obviously like the contractions starting to get closer together. And at this point, it's much later in the evening on the 3rd. And I said to my husband, it's like, can you just take me to hospital? Because I just need something. I haven't slept. I'm so tired. I'm in so much pain. I just want someone to check me over. So he took me to the hospital and they checked me and they were like, yep, you know, very early contractions, not even dilated. So here, we'll give you some cocodamol so that you can at least get a couple hours sleep. I was like, perfect. I just want to sleep. Mm-hmm. So I went home, took them. By that point, it's the 4th of November and it's early in the morning and the contractions are starting to get closer. But again, it's been over 24 hours and I'm just on the floor, like leaning over an exercise ball. My husband's just like rubbing my back because the pain in my back was just so immense. Mm. And then it got to the point later in the afternoon, where I was like, because I was timing the contractions, like, right, they're at that point where I can go in. Because what I'd been told from the healthcare is obviously around that time, around end of October, early November, there was, you know, word of a potential second lockdown. It still wasn't confirmed if partners could come into the hospital or not when you're going into labour. If you weren't in established labour, they wouldn't let you stay. They'd rather you stay at home. So I had all this in my head and I was like, I want to make sure I'm definitely in established labour because I don't want to go in by myself. Mm. I don't want to be in a room by myself going through this. And I don't want my husband to have to sit in the car and just wait for me to text, say, right, okay, you're allowed to come in now. So I rang my midwife as like, my contractions are at the point where I can go in, you know, I want to go in. I want to be seen. Because it's now heading towards the 36-hour mark. And she said, you're fine to go in. She said, but I'm pretty sure they're just going to turn you away and send you back home. That's fine. I just want to get checked out.
Yeah.
So went to the hospital and they took me into the side room, obviously did a few checks and then they took my blood pressure and they're like, your blood pressure's really high. We're going to leave you here for an hour. We'll come back and check on you. And thankfully they let my husband stay in the room with me, but he wasn't allowed to leave that room. So we were both in this tiny little room and they came back in an hour, blood pressure's still too high. So I was like, okay. And then they checked me and said, you're actually 3 centimeters dilated. Let me speak to a midwife and we'll see what the plan is. And then they came back in and said, right, okay, you're 3 centimeters dilated, your blood pressure's still too high. We're going to keep you in. We are going to potentially induce you, break your waters and take it from there. But what will happen now is because we're going to give you tablets to bring your blood pressure down, you're going to have to be monitored constantly. So you are going to be on the bed. You won't be able to move around, which is what I originally wanted during my labour. I wanted to be able to move and, you know, just not be tied to a bed essentially. And so I was like, okay, if that's what you need to do. And they ended up giving me 3 of these blood pressure tablets and my blood pressure was still too high. So they did it. They broke my waters and that was probably about 8 p.m. on the 4th of November. Mm. But then Henry, my baby, so we didn't know what we were having. We kept it as a surprise. He wasn't born until 5 a.m., so at that point, I'd been in late, well, I'd had contractions for over 2 days.
Yeah.
I'd hardly slept. I was just absolutely exhausted. And I was only given gas and air prior to obviously starting to push and things. And then because I found out the hemorrhage back to back. And that's why the pressure on my back was so immense, especially with the contractions. So I had like a monitor on my belly, but where he was back to back, they couldn't always pick him up and they kept losing his heartbeat. So obviously I remember the machine because it's right by my head and I can hear it beeping, and then it would sometimes stop and it'd beep again and it would stop. So I was starting to panic, and they put a clip on his head, but then the clip fell out. And my husband was trying to get the midwife's attention, going, that doesn't look right. And he's pointing at the machine and she's like, no, it's fine. He said, no, like, that's not right. The machine's not right. Something's wrong. And then she realized, oh, the clip's fallen off his head, and then had to put it back in. And I was just on the bed and I was just lying there like completely helpless, because I was like, I was just in so much pain and I was so tired. And then when they said, right, okay, now's the time to push. So I pushed for an hour. And they had put my legs in stirrups, which I don't really remember happening. I just remember my legs being moved and they were like elevated. And I pushed for an hour, and then they brought a doctor in and said, right, okay, this situation, been pushing for an hour, you know, baby's obviously not here. What do we do next? And the doctor said, okay, we'll try pushing for another 15 minutes and we'll see what happens. And at this point, I'm still like, I've had no pain relief. I'm in agony. I can't move. I'm tired. My husband told me I was actually falling asleep in between contractions.
And just going back to this pain relief point, why is that? Because it sounds like you are in a lot of pain and it's difficult. And they're only prescribing gas and air. Is there a reason for that? Did they tell you, or is it your choice?
They didn't tell me. It definitely wasn't my choice. I said to my husband when I went in, I was like, I definitely want an epidural, because this pain is incredible. Like, I just can't. And I'd always strived myself. Pre-pregnancy, I was a very fit person. You know, I'd go to the gym 4 or 5 times a week. I was very athletic. And I was like, you know, that's why during my pregnancy, I walked every day. I'd go for 2-hour walks every day. And I was still very mobile throughout my entire pregnancy. And so I was like, a very strong person. My pain threshold was strong, but I was like, no, I need an epidural. Like, I need to have something to take the edge off, because this is just too much. I can't do anything, because it's just blocking everything. It's blocking like my mind, my thought process, everything. And I'm not too sure as to why an epidural was never administered early. And then, because it got to the point where I'd been pushing this extra 15 minutes and I said, but I haven't had an epidural, where's my epidural? And at this point, the doctor came in and said, right, okay, this is a situation. Your heart rate and your blood pressure is just too erratic. The baby's starting to struggle now as well. The baby's too far down for us to take you in for a C-section. So either we do forceps, get him out now, get baby out now, or we will take you to theatre, give you an epidural. We'll have to wait 20 minutes, but your husband can't come with you. And so at that point in my head, I was like, well, you've told me baby needs to come out, and you're telling me that if I have an epidural, that's going to delay, and that my husband can't be there with me. Do forceps, like, just get the baby out. And so at that point they came, and obviously they informed other people around, right, okay, forceps, get everything ready. My legs are still in stirrups, and because I hadn't had any pain relief, so they said, okay, what we're going to do is going to inject you to like numb the area pretty much. And at this point, they did an episiotomy. They did that to the angle on one side. I'm still not too sure what side, surprisingly. And then they used forceps to get Henry out. But I think where they just administered the numbing or the pain relief, whatever it was, it didn't work, and I felt everything. And I just remember thinking, I screamed. But I had the gas and air in my mouth, so I think that kind of muffled the noise. But I felt him coming out, and I just remember it felt like my pelvis like broke because of like him coming out. And then because we didn't know what we're having, they held him up and they were like, it's a boy. And I just remember looking up, and it sounds so crass, but I was just like, all I could see was this bright red ball bag. And I was like, oh my God, that's a boy. Like, that really is a boy. And then they took him off to weigh him. And so obviously my husband's there, and he's like, oh, like, what's the weight? And they're like, we don't know. What do you mean you don't know? Oh, well, in kilos, he's 5.2 kilos. And we're like, well, what's that in pounds? They said, well, we don't know because it's off the chart. And they held this chart up and it only went up to 5 kilos. And I was just like, oh my God, what does that mean? Like, what's just happened? And it turns out he was 11 pound two. He was a big baby.
Very big baby.
Very big baby. And I was just lying there. Like, I still didn't really understand what just happened.
Yeah.
Obviously, I knew the pain. And then they put him on my chest to obviously try and do, you know, the golden hour and try and get him to latch on and things. But at this point, because where I had monitors on me, I had blood pressure on my arm, I had a cannula in my hand, I was kind of strapped up already. So I hadn't prepared. So I still had my top on. So I had to cut my top off to get to the skin to then get him against me. And then after that, I remember they injected me in order to help the placenta out.
And just going back just a step to the birth and the episiotomy and everything that just happened there. Nairi, first of all, what is an episiotomy, if people are wondering? And what is your take on this situation?
Well, going back, first of all, to the pain relief, I don't really understand it because Samantha was an excellent candidate for somebody that needed an epidural because I could almost tell that the baby had been back to back because of the length of time she'd been at home and the fact that she had excruciating back pain. And then when they monitored him, it was quite clear that he was in the back-to-back position. And for somebody who had been through such a long labour and was exhausted, an epidural would have given her a really important rest and given her then more energy to hopefully push her baby out. But also, it would have lowered her blood pressure. And Samantha had high blood pressure and epidurals are very good for lowering blood pressure. So I'm quite surprised at the decision-making. I can only assume that it was COVID-related.
Mm.
An episiotomy is a surgical cut to enlarge the opening of the perineum to give more room for the baby to come out. It was a good idea in Samantha's case because, well, they have to do it for forceps anyway, but when you have a known big baby, one of the risk factors is that the baby can get stuck coming out.
Mm.
And so therefore they need more room to do various maneuvers to enable a baby to come out. And thankfully that wasn't necessary. So that was really good. But it's basically a cut where it's angled away from the anal sphincter to avoid damaging that muscle. Mm. So that's why it's done at that sort of 45 degree angle. Have I got 45 degrees right? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And so the person doing it will cut usually to the left-hand side. So therefore, it would be on your right-hand side.
Yeah.
Samantha, yes. And it does actually heal very well.
Mm.
People are very worried about them, but as long as you get good care and you eat well and there's good hygiene, they usually repair themselves very well.
Mm.
They do take, obviously, a bit of time. And it means that breastfeeding can be challenging because you're sitting on the wound a lot. So you need help with breastfeeding. You need good pain relief. But it's just basically a very important maneuver sometimes in having a baby.
And has it also something to do with wanting to avoid a tear?
Not really, actually, because if there is a choice between a cut and a tear will often heal better because you have two rough edges that knit together, but it is avoiding a tear down into the anal sphincter. So if you feel that somebody is going to tear badly, then an episiotomy can be done for that reason as well.
Okay.
But for a forceps delivery, which is why Samantha had it, it's done to allow more room to put the forceps alongside the baby's head.
Mm. So it sounds like it was very, well, I would say traumatic, that bit of the birth.
Yeah, well, sad to say that actually wasn't the traumatic bit for me. It was the next bit that followed. Like after the So after the placenta had been delivered, I started to go very faint. And all I remember is it was like being underwater and all the sounds are muffled. And then suddenly I'm getting pinched and I can feel pinches like on the back of my hand, in the corner of my elbow, on the side of my leg. And at this point, my husband's holding my hand and Henry's on my chest. And I'm just looking at my husband and I'm just saying, do you want to hold Henry? And I just kept repeating it, saying, do you want to hold Henry? And he's just looking at me and I see him mouth something, but I don't know what he says. And then that's the last thing I remember. And what I didn't realize at the time and what I found out after was that actually I'd hemorrhaged and my husband was standing in my blood and he was just, sorry. Yeah. He was just holding my hand and he didn't want to hold Henry because he wanted me to hold him as long as possible because he thought I was going to die. Because obviously, you know, when you go in for labor, you don't really expect to be in that situation. And because what he told me afterwards as well was they'd actually called a code red and there were sirens going off and people running in trying to get to me. And he was just stood there, just holding my hand. Everyone's going, don't worry, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. She's going to be fine. And he was just like, but I'm in her blood. You know, that's not fine. Mm. And I don't remember anything. David and I have only spoken about this twice, maybe, because it's really hard to talk about. And we think there's about 5 hours that I can't account for. So those first 5 hours of Henry's life, I don't have any memories. I don't know what happened. Mm. It was really scary. Mm. And then I remember when I came round and obviously I was still in the bed and I just looked up and I'm in a white room and there was light coming in. And I just remember sitting there and I was like, oh my God, is this it? Like, has something really terrible happened? And then all of a sudden it's like I came back into focus and I looked and David and Henry were to my left and I was like, oh no, okay, like it's okay, I'm here. Mm. And I then just remember the pain because what had happened was even though they'd done the episiotomy, I'd actually torn on the other side at an angle, thankfully. So I had two cuts essentially. And I tried to get up because I was like, I need to go to the toilet. Mm. And I tried to stand up and I passed out. So David had to call, pull the cord and get some help to try and pick me back up, essentially. Yeah, and then I just remember a midwife came in and she just looked at us both. She's like, you look shell-shocked. Mm. Like, what's happened? And we were like, we don't really know. Mm. Don't really know what's happened. And I found out later that the midwives were asking David when Henry first came out, and they're like, did you not know who's going to be this big? And he was like, no, no one told us. No one told us that he was that size. Mm.
And so that bleed that you had, the hemorrhage that you had, was that from the extra scar or was it from the placenta?
So I don't know.
No.
What happened during my labour, I was never debriefed by a doctor. I was never debriefed by a midwife. No one told me what happened. I found out about the tear from my husband. He told me. I found out that apparently my placenta was swollen. I found out from David. Everything I found out was secondhand. And moving on a bit forward, so I was told at that time, once I just had Henry, there is like a birth afterthoughts support group that you can actually request to have a meeting with one of the midwives who will take you through your notes and explain what's happened to you. And again, because of COVID, I had to wait 6 months for that. So I spent 6 months not even knowing what grey tear I had,
yeah,
let alone what had happened. And it was really hard. And then, like you say, Nairi, with the episiotomy, obviously, as that's healing, you're sat on it. And after having Henry and after the hemorrhage and everything, and then it got to about 4 p.m. in the afternoon, and they're like, look, we're going to have to move you to the labor ward, but obviously your husband can't come with you. He's going to have to go. So I was moved to the labour ward, and at this point it's 5th of November, it's fireworks night, and I just remember I was lying in the bed and had Henry on me, and the fireworks were going off, and I was just in so much pain because every time I tried to move, I was on the episiotomy or I was on the tear. So I couldn't move comfortably. Trying to get Henry to get him to latch on was excruciating. And every time I moved, I thought I was like doing more damage. And it was just a horrible, horrible time, to be honest.
Do you understand?
I'm so sorry you went through that. It just sounds horrific. And I'm sorry that you didn't get the debriefing, because I think that can be so useful, so helpful.
Naomi, in terms of the hemorrhage, just from your experience, what would you guess could have happened?
A forceps delivery always increases the risk of having a hemorrhage, because it's usually happening because a labour has been prolonged. And in Samantha's case, her uterus had been working really hard for 3 days and three nights. And it was an overstretched uterus, because when you have a very big baby, you have a very big placenta. You also have extra amniotic fluid. So Samantha's poor uterus, and I do like to think about uteruses as people, because it's helpful, but I think that it was a very overworked, tired uterus. And what happens when a placenta comes away is you need all of the individual muscle fibers in the uterus to contract down to slow the bleeding. And I just think Samantha's uterus had given up the ghost. It was exhausted. And you know, it was very likely to have completely relaxed. So whilst there would have been some bleeding undoubtedly from the episiotomy and from the tear, the kind of major hemorrhage which Samantha is describing would, I think, almost certainly have been from the placenta. And, you know, we're talking about big volumes of blood, and it's why Samantha passed out. And the whole thing just sounds awful. So I'm really sorry that it happened to you.
Yeah. And so you are in the hospital.
Yeah.
And you're obviously very exhausted and tired and in pain. How long do you stay in hospital for, and when do you get home?
So I stayed in overnight, and I was waiting for obviously Henry to have his various checks, his hearing, obviously his weight, he passed that with flying colours, and like all of his little blood tests and everything. And they actually let me go home around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I believe. And I was so happy. I just wanted to get home. And, you know, because not only had I spent the night alone after what just happened, but my husband had. He'd had to go home to an empty house, and just because the 5th of November was the official start of the second lockdown. So he couldn't even go to anyone and gain some comfort about what just happened. So he came and got me, and we went home, and we had our first night home. And obviously, as babies do, they scream all night. And then we had a midwife visit the next day, where obviously they take the baby's weight to make sure they haven't lost too much weight. And unfortunately, because Henry had lost a lot of weight, he'd lost 11% of his body weight. So I got sent back into the hospital for him to be monitored over a time period to make sure that he was feeding properly. So I had to go back into the hospital by myself, and I cried the entire car journey there, because I just did not want to go back. I was just like, I feel like I've just got out of there and I'm being sent back. But also as well, I felt like I failed Henry, because he hadn't eaten. I think he'd only latched on a couple times in that kind of 24-hour time period. And when I got into the hospital, because I was trying to breastfeed, and obviously no milk had come in yet, and that would take time. And when I got into the hospital, they said, okay, like we'll do a little meal plan for him. And what we'll do is we do top ups. So you breastfeed first and then you can top up with formula. And I just sat there and I was like, why wasn't I told this before? No one told me that I could top up. I said, otherwise I would have done it and I wouldn't be back here. Mm-hmm. I could still be at home. Mm-hmm. And then again, they watched him and checked him and see the meal plan was taking effect. And then they weighed him later on the next day. And he managed to gain, I think, about 500 grams. And like, okay, like, we're fine for you to go back home. Mm. So I got sent back home again. But then at this point, been in and out of hospital, I was just so tired and I was just in so much pain. But also, David had already used a week of his paternity leave because of where my contractions had started and it's taken so long. So then he was only at home with us for a week. And then he had to go back to work.
Mm.
And then obviously lockdown restrictions are in place. So again, no help. But at least at this point, you could form a bubble.
Mm.
And my parents live quite close. So my mum and my dad were our bubble, essentially. And my mum took some time off and she spent a week with me. Because even trying to, like you say, trying to breastfeed with an episiotomy is... It was so difficult and our house is a lovely house, but it's got three floors.
Mm.
So trying to get down those stairs, it was a very slow process for me. And it took me a long time to gain like more mobility and stuff as like the tear and the episiotomy healed.
You must have been exhausted from the blood loss as well.
And yeah. Like,
and the labour being so long.
Yeah. Yeah. I was, to be honest, it's all just a bit of a blur now. And I just remember, I don't think I've ever cried so much, surprisingly. Like, I was just so exhausted and then, like, trying to breastfeed. And then, because at times, because obviously I was still so swollen as well, even after the birth, like, my ankles were still the size of my thighs. And I remember I was in the shower and I was trying to have a shower and I just looked down and I was like, I don't think my ankles are ever going to come back. Like, it just sounds really silly. But I was like, oh my God, my ankles, they're gone. everything was just so hard. And then it was just the fact that the lockdown was in place again as well. So I couldn't eat, even if I needed help, I couldn't get it.
Mm.
You know, you weren't allowed to have people in your house apart from your bubble. And my parents were still working. So there's only so much that they could do. But thankfully, you know, I got to see a midwife face to face for the 3 days and then like the time after that as well. And then the health visitor came round when I was 10 days postpartum. And it was actually... I told her what happened with the birth and obviously cried a lot and just said, you know, I don't really understand what happened. And she was the one who told me about the Birth Trauma Association. She said, there's, you know, a group, a Facebook group, they're like a support group and you can share your story if you want, it's up to you, which up until now I haven't really.
Mm.
And, but she said, you know, she was the first person who said that it sounds like you've had birth trauma.
Mm.
Like, you know, I think you need to look into getting some help or, you know, just speaking to someone or having something there that you can go to.
Mm.
And so I started to do that. But again, it was a very slow recovery. I was on iron tablets to help with the blood loss. I was on them for about 3 months, I think. And I was meant to have blood tests done every 3 months. But again, that only happened once and didn't happen. And then it wasn't until my birthing afterthought session, which was 6 months postpartum, that I kind of found out what happened.
Mm.
But still, you know, I've still got questions. And, you know, thankfully I've got some answers today as to understand a bit more as to what happened and why it happened. Mm. And during that talk, they were like, well, you know, when you have your next child. And I laughed. I was like, next child. Like, after that I don't think there will be another child. And the midwife who was doing the session, she was like, oh well, don't worry, because next time, you know, you'll be monitored a lot more closely and what will happen is we'll have your blood in the room so that if anything does happen again, because you are at a higher risk of having another hemorrhage because you've already had one, you know, your blood will be in the room, it'll be available. And you know, we we probably won't go down the natural birth route again. We'll probably have to have a C-section. And I just said to her, I was like, honestly, I don't think that's ever going to happen because I'm scared now. Mm-hmm. Now that's happened once. I feel lucky that it didn't turn out worse. So why would I put myself through that risk? Why would I put Henry and my husband through that risk of me potentially being more damaged, mm. you know, physically, mentally? Why would I do that? Mm. And they just seemed so intent on saying, oh, don't worry, next time, next time. It just really, really put me off, to be honest.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your story, Samantha.
That's okay.
Yeah, it was very hard to listen to at times.
Mm.
It must have been a very difficult experience. Yeah, so thank you.
Thank you
very much.